I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome to Radio Times. I can tell from hosting the show that there's deep anxiety about the challenges facing us, worry that our leaders and political system are not up to the task, and concern that partisanship is isolating people who can't even agree on a common set of facts. The internet offers a set of tools and strategies to deal with those challenges, especially in foreign policy. That's what Anne-Marie Slaughter writes in her new book, The Chessboard and the Web. The chessboard refers to countries, to borders, a top-down hierarchy, hard power, and winning. The web is a world of networks that intersect and overlap over shared interests, and it knows no boundaries. That can be an international writers group or ISIS. I sat down with Anne-Marie Slaughter last Friday afternoon before an audience of WHYY donors and supporters at Princeton University, one of the perks of membership. She's the president and CEO of the think tank New America. She was the first woman to serve as director of policy and planning for the State Department under Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. She's the former dean of Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. I always have too many pieces of paper, but I will try. I might be throwing them all over the floor here. This is an optimistic book, and we live not necessarily in a pessimistic time, but I think a time of great anxiety. What gives you optimism?
Well, I did write the book. I finished the book last June.
That helps us understand. Okay.
So, yes, that's part of it. But I think now the book was written in a different time than it's been published. And I think how you read it obviously changes. But what I am optimistic about is that we will do better in the world. And when I say we, I mean government officials, but I also mean heads of any businesses, and I mean anyone involved in civic groups. I mean anyone who's engaged in the world and has some agency to affect a global problem. All of us will do better if we know how to think about building networks strategically, that we know we're interconnected. My goodness, you know, I took my first foreign policy class in the Woodrow Wilson School in the fall of 77, and the work was power and interdependence. Power, that's the chessboard. Interdependence, that's the web. We know we're interconnected. What we don't know is how strategically to be connected in the right way, or sometimes disconnected, so that we don't get hurt. So I'm optimistic that with this set of tools, we will do better, even as our challenges mount.
Well, and there are many challenges. Some of them come from a state or the chessboard, whether that's North Korea or other countries that we're dealing with. And then there are the more interconnected challenges, whether it's climate change or pandemics, as you write, or even terrorism. These are challenges that know no boundaries.
Exactly.
How do we deal with that?
So just think about this week. Right, just the sort of what's been in the headlines in the last 7 days, and you would think, well, Park Chung, the president, obviously, of South Korea, who suddenly is impeached, and now all of a sudden we don't have a leader in a state that borders one of the most dangerous states in the world. That state is developing intercontinental ballistic missiles to put nuclear warheads on them, and we've got a huge challenge. Now, that is a more traditionally chessboard challenge. You're worried about North Korea. There's not a lot of one of the problems with North Korea is it's not interconnected with the rest of the world, and we don't have that.
It doesn't have electricity for many people.
Yes, we don't have a lot of the tools we might otherwise use. So that's a chessboard problem where you're thinking, I've got to deal with North Korea, and now I've got a problem in South Korea, and China is there, and Japan is there, and we have troops in South Korea. So that's a chessboard problem. Same time, we've just had a massive dump on WikiLeaks of all the ways that our intelligence communities fight cyber war or engage in cyber conflict or try to protect us. That's a web problem. There is no way to make us secure from a cyber point of view only through governments. The connections, it's everybody on a computer every time we connect to the internet. So you're going to have a web, a network of networks that involves governments, every business, civic organizations. I'm sure all of you have now, many of us use two-factor authentication and all sorts of other ways of being more protected. We're going to have to design networks that involve everyone and that are effective both at deterring people and also protecting ourselves. So you've got both problems.
You know, as I was reading your book, I was thinking about the Arab Spring, which of course started when a man who sold food on a street corner set himself on fire. Then we saw this protest movement inspired and communicating through Twitter. We saw some possibility of a new kind of future in the Middle East. And then the government moved in and quashed all of this, which makes you sometimes feel like the chessboard is going to win. But you're telling us maybe not in ways that we understand.
Yes, that it's a great example, actually, the Arab Spring, because indeed we named those revolutions Twitter revolutions for a while. That was not true, right? They communicated through Twitter, but really what was driving them were domestic discontents. But those were fanned by seeing, well, if other countries can do it, we can do it too. I remember somebody in Egypt telling me that if the Tunisian football clubs could rise up and overthrow a government, well, then the Egyptian football clubs could too. Mm. That there was this sense of real being connected and interconnected. Even more, though, and I think a lot of people didn't realize this, there were groups that had been groomed by people designing networks to try to strengthen democracy, actually starting in Serbia. Right, the Otpor, the group that really was instrumental in bringing Milosevic down, that group had been in touch with groups in Tunisia, in Egypt, in Turkey, and that had been a designed network. So yes, there a lot of kind of connectedness there that was important. But you're right, when a state decides to use violence in more traditional tools, I wouldn't say. I don't know that they won. I'm not sure I would say Bashar al-Assad has won. He's destroyed his country utterly. He will never be able to put it back together. But certainly you can't imagine just designing a network that's going to address that problem. The way I would think about it is that if you have a network perspective, you should have understood sooner that what happened to people was really going to matter. In other words, you shouldn't have just looked at Syria, let's take that one, sure, back in 2011 or 2012, and said, I think as the President Obama said, well, from a chessboard perspective, Turkey's okay, Israel's okay, Saudi Arabia's okay, those are our allies in the region, there's no direct interest here, we don't have a sort of stake from a chessboard perspective. So let's not do anything other than kind of cosmetic things. From a web perspective, you should have understood that if you allow a government to massacre its own people, they will first of all run, so that you're going to displace people and you're going to get refugees. But second, they're going to fight back. And if you don't help them, they will get help from other places. And they are in a world already where you have terrorist networks. And fundamentally then, over time, if you don't help them, you're going to get forces that destabilize the region, destabilize Europe, and we've seen a real resurgence of, obviously, ISIL. A web perspective would have helped you see that in ways you could have marshaled state action.
Well, I know, I believe you were someone who called for, if not intervention, at least doing more than what the Obama administration did. But from that net or that web perspective, what would have been the right thing to do, especially in such a chaotic part of the world?
Well, so I think I should be clear that it's an extremely difficult problem. So obviously I'm going to say I would have done this, and we don't know. What I would say, though, was that back in 2012, from this interconnected perspective, you could see these problems coming. I would have created a safe zone, right? And it's interesting, as Secretary Clinton finally came around to safe zones, even President Trump talked about safe zones briefly, although it seems to have fallen off the screen. But the reason is we don't want to go in and protect people. And I understand it's dangerous, although we did it. We've done it before. We've done it sometimes well and sometimes not. But my proposition would have been you, A, have to show that you are, in fact, doing what you say you're about. If you say that a government can't massacre its people and you have the ability to try to protect them, you should. That would have, I think, first of all, sent different messages to people watching. But equally, that would have raised the costs for the government. And the government would have understood, well, yes, they could continue massacring their people, but they were going to then have to trip over us. I would have also built a coalition of states in the area, not for the purposes of defeating the government, but protecting the people.
So how do you think about building a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border? How does that – I mean, that seems like a pushback to what you are saying. And I'll add to that, even the ban on refugees or the yes. temporary ban on refugees coming into the country, that's – I don't even know if that's chessboard, no. but it feels almost medieval in a certain kind of way.
Yes, the walled enclosure, the fortress town, but fortress America, and we have been there before. So one way of understanding that is a desperate effort to deny the existence of the web. Just to say, nope, we're going back to a world in which we control our borders absolutely. We are a state among other states. If you listen to the inaugural address and President Trump said, we're a state and we have our interests and we advance our interests and so does everybody else. That is pure chessboard. Mm. And it's an effort to just sort of deny reality because, yes, we can put up a wall. Do we think in the first place, yes, that will stop, certainly will stop some immigration. We still have oceans. We still have ways over and under walls. I mean, but equally, you're going to disrupt all sorts of family relationships and business relationships and civic relationships, and that's going to be very damaging. Mm. So,
maybe even costly.
Very, in many ways. I mean, just to think about, again, as a ban. On the one hand, it is true that in a web world, you have to find new ways of protecting your polity. So you go back to cyber crime. We understand that clearly. Even immigration, right? I'm the daughter of a Belgian. I believe in immigration, but if we just went a little ways over to the philosophy department or the political theory department, you'd hear lots of people saying, yes, we're founded on universal values, but we can't just have open borders. Right? We do have to protect our borders, and we do have to have a sensible policy. But you really can't just try to pretend that we are 200 years back. You've got to find ways to manage the connections and figure out, okay, how connected can we be and where do we have to be and where can we make it a little more difficult?
More from Anne-Marie Slaughter after this very short break, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. You're listening to an interview I recorded with Anne-Marie Slaughter last Friday before an audience of WHYY donors and members. We've been talking about her new book, The Chessboard and the Web. She's the head of the think tank New America, served in the State Department under Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who she supported for president. I wanted to get her opinions about the Trump administration and the challenges facing his State Department under Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. But first, I wanted to know if she understood Trump's appeal to his voters. Why do you think America First or Make America Great Again, why do you think that had and continues to have such appeal to so many Americans?
So I do think, what at least people like me have to listen to is that, globalization has been far better for some of us than others of us. Globalization and technology both. I remember realizing somewhere back in the 1990s as a professor, wow, this great thing called the internet, you know, I can put up a course and now I can teach it in 20 different places at once, right? And now I can go around and instead of once being tied to one university, suddenly I have the world at my fingertips, quite literally. Well, that was my job. That was a knowledge job. That was a job that's going to benefit, right? If I were somebody, obviously, in a factory or in any number of jobs that moved, whether because of globalization or technology or both, you had a very, very different reaction. And I often think that many of the people I interact with live in airport world. Right? Airport world is a boring world. It's the same, you know, shops wherever you are. But it is this kind of global elite that literally circulates around from airport to airport. So what I think we have to hear is there is nothing wrong with saying, no, we're going to put the interests of Americans first, in the sense of we're going to pay attention to our jobs and think about all Americans. There's nothing wrong with that. And I think that's what's resonating. But what's also resonating is this just deep insecurity, right? Where suddenly Ebola, you know, remember the terror of Ebola. I mean, I was living in Washington and somebody landed in Maryland who had Ebola and all of Washington practically shut down. It was not a proud moment for our country. But this fear that suddenly this thing or this cyber virus or Russian spying, that things are coming at us and we want to seal ourselves off. I think that too, that kind of notion that you can do that, for many people, that's just comforting. And we have to hear it. And respond emotionally as well as intellectually, rather than demonizing people who may feel that way and may have voted on the other side.
That is really hard to do. I mean, I think for everybody to be able to hear either a worldview or a perspective or the different set of facts that people seem to be operating in. I mean, I do believe there are a real set of facts, but then there are the facts that people believe because it makes them feel good.
Yes, but let me set some boundaries of my own, right? I think we also have to say, you know, we are founded on a set of values, all of us, we also believe in, if not exact truth, at least that there are things that are more, you know, you can get pretty close. There are facts. I really do believe we're standing in the math department, right? 2 + 2 does still equal 4, maybe not in the quantum level, but we're not going there.
No, don't go there.
Don't go there.
Please.
I think we can say violence is out of the question, and I don't care if it comes from the right, the left, the center, or anywhere else. It is wrong, and you stand up for that. You stand up against hate. You stand up against racism. You stand up against hate against anyone. So you have to do that. But at the same time, then, you have got to be able to find to leave your own sort of identity and really exercise your imagination for what it feels like to be someone. I often think, since I've written on work and family, I think about the 55-year-old white man who not only has lost his job, but his world has been turned upside down. He can't support his family. Women are being, in his view, and he's probably seen it because I've seen it. I've benefited from it. Women have been promoted when he hasn't been because we wanted diversity. That was a good thing. But in his view, he didn't necessarily discriminate. Right? He wasn't necessarily the perpetrator of the things that we're trying to redress as a society. So I try to imagine, what would it be to be that man and to be scared that I can't support my own family? I no longer have the role that I believed that I was supposed to have. I don't know what's going to happen to my children. And somebody comes along and says, I'm going to solve all those problems. I don't agree with the way he chose, but boy, I think we need to hear that and address it. And the demonization is deeply dangerous, right? They're racist, they're, you know, horrific globalists, cosmopolitans, a word we hear again, which has really nasty resonance. But there's the stuff, nasty stuff going on both sides.
What do you make of the fact, though, that the President Trump, first candidate Trump, but President Trump has never said anything negative about Vladimir Putin? What do you make of that? As someone who's, you know, lives and lived within that world. It's just, I find it confounding.
Well, so I think we will find out to what extent his views of Vladimir Putin might be tied to contacts with Russia that may be illegal, maybe certainly deeply, deeply, deeply troubling. I'm just going to, I believe in our system, and I believe those facts will come out. It may take a while. But I want to offer a different reason,
sure,
which is really quite discernible if you just know where to look, which is there's a fantastic article in last week's New Yorker by David Remnick and Evan Osnos and Joshua Yaffe that tells you really Putin's origins and ties it to Russia. And there's a great line in there that says Putin didn't really care about communism, but he deeply cares about Russia. And Russia was in deep trouble by the end of the 1990s. You know, Yeltsin really basically steps down and says, I'm sorry, I couldn't bring the world about that I promised. And it says, you know, Putin needed an idea of Russia that would put Russia back on its feet. And that idea, and I studied Russia when I was here, that idea was what you'd call the Slavophile idea of Russia. It is deeply religious, it's Russian Orthodox, it's conservative, and it's anti-European. And remember, he was anti-gay, it is a deeply sort of patriarchal view, and culturally conservative and nationalist, and Russia fighting external enemies. Now, what does that sound like? Right? If you look at what Steve Bannon writes, it's not Russian Orthodox, it's Catholic, when he was in, and not all Catholic, a particular kind, version of Catholicism. It is culturally conservative, deeply patriarchal. Has anybody noticed that there are no women in the pictures in the White House anymore? I mean, none? Really, almost none. So deeply patriarchal. They have not chosen a woman to do anything substantive. Let me reframe. Education is important, I understand.
Right.
But no, and so is transport, and so is the UN. But no money, no guns, no sort of the core big offices. So deeply patriarchal, and deeply, you know, he says, the Judeo-Christian world is under attack. So one reason you can understand why he has not criticized President Putin is because this is an idea of America that matches Putin's idea of Russia. And in both cases, they're going way back to an earlier time, but they're tapping into a particular tradition that some people find comforting and that at least offers a coherent worldview.
So how do you think the United States now looks to the rest of the world? I mean, the rest of the world, there are almost 200 countries, so obviously it's going to be different. But and it's not as if President Obama didn't make mistakes and do things that I'm sure he regretted. But how do you think the world looks at us now?
Well, with a mixture.
Are they laughing at us?
Well, I think they would be laughing at us if they weren't so frightened. Yes, I mean, I was just talking to somebody in Canada. You know, the Canadians are all looking at us going, okay, you know, but many countries, many of our allies in Asia, in Europe, in the Middle East are really frightened because the world order has been changing and it must change. And you can't imagine a world in 2045 that's still run by the countries that won the World War II in 1945, right? It was going to change. But what we hoped was a kind of gradual devolution and greater inclusion of other countries and broadening of power, but still an order that has rules that holds. There's no sign that President Trump has any interest in upholding that order. He wants to do bilateral deals with people. And that means what would happen tomorrow if Iraq invaded Kuwait? Who would lead? Who would say, no, this can't stand. We need a coalition. This was one reason I was so upset with President Obama on Syria, because if we're not there, guess who's deciding Syria? Russia and Iran and Turkey a little bit. But we're not there to stand and say, no, no, no. You know, maybe we're not going to get everything we want, but these are the rules. This is what has to happen. So you have a lot of countries that are afraid now that nobody's in charge, and then you have chaos, or that powers who want very different rules. And Putin invaded Crimea, and when he did, he said, this is totally legal. It was a legal view, right? That why shouldn't he could do that in the Baltics. Who's going to stop him? Now, I think NATO would. But I think there's disbelief, there's, yes, sort of humor, but above all, there's real fear.
Having worked for Hillary Clinton in the State Department, are you concerned at all about the new Secretary of State? Apparently, he hasn't been invited to meetings or some meetings with world leaders. There's a question about whether the Trump administration is going to defund some of the secretary, yes. the State Department, give more money to the Defense Department. Where do you think that leaves the state, and what does that tell us about the current Secretary of State?
So I was, as you were asking me that question, I was thinking Secretary Clinton would tell me, do not answer that question in public.
Well, you no longer work for
her. I don't,
but yes.
I'm thinking that's what she would. You know, I am. So I am not convinced that Secretary Tillerson is as out of it as many newspaper accounts suggest. I think, but what I'm fairly certain of, and other administrations have done this too, and when I was in the State Department, we complained about the White House, but not like this, but, you know, they want to run American foreign policy from the White House. And one of the ways they're going to do that is not to fill these jobs at state. They're cutting staff. They're cutting the lifeline staff between the seventh floor and the rest of the building. What normally happens, so when I began working for Secretary Clinton 2 days after she was confirmed, because the director of policy planning also does not need to be confirmed by the Senate, so I was able to go in right away. Everybody around the table, we'd have these meetings of 35 assistant secretaries of state for every country you can imagine and every issue area. They were all foreign service. They're all acting secretaries of state. And then you have the political appointees, and they come in, they get confirmed, and they come in over the next 3 months. And then you have kind of the connective tissue between the secretary and the building, because she talks to her appointees, and then her appointees all work with the career people. Well, they're cutting that out. They're not going to fill a lot of those positions, and they're cutting a lot of staff. And what that means is you have a lot of foreign service officers who are admirable professionals who have no direction. And we saw that when Prime Minister Netanyahu came, there was nobody from the State Department was there. The Assistant Secretary for Near East Studies, who actually knows something about the entire Middle East, not there. So I'm quite worried, not so much about Secretary Tillerson, but about what this means about who's going to be really making policy.
Here's a question from one of our people here. Several questions concern the departure of senior staff members leaving the State Department. What does that mean in the way the department functions? People leaving.
Yes. So this is a more complicated story, I think, than the press reported. Patrick Kennedy was the undersecretary for management, had been for a long time, very well-regarded person, had been there since George Shultz had been there, and he was fired, and he was fired very quickly. But what people didn't report was he was responsible for diplomatic security during the Benghazi crisis. So he had a target on his back from Congress. I did not surprise me at all that he was let go, because if you were following Benghazi, he was blamed for that. And he and his core team were let go. That, I think, is less troubling than what they're, I was not happy about it, but I could understand it. But that's not quite as troubling as what's happening now, as I said, where you're just effectively leaving disconnecting the Foreign Service from the political decision-making. That's going to mean you've got people in embassies all over the world who have no idea what we're actually going to do and will have no ability to tell their counterparts in their countries what we're going to do. That's terrible. That's like disconnecting the steering of a car.
Creating an obvious vacuum. So who fills that vacuum?
Whatever comes out of the White House.
Well, and I wonder whether if it's sort of demoting the State Department but elevating the Defense Department,
what is the policy that will be then instituted, and does that then create the conditions for some kind of military intervention?
Well, now it's a very good question. I don't think it creates the conditions for military intervention because the State Department is typically more pro-intervention than the Defense Department.
And I have actually heard that.
Yes,
but yes,
and remember Madeleine Albright said to Secretary Powell, you know, what good is this great? He wasn't secretary then; he was still as a general. What good is this army of yours if you're not going to use it? So I don't think that's the problem, but what is the problem, and anybody in the military, Lindsey Graham said this openly at his town hall last week on CNN, he said, we can't win these wars militarily. And if you want to win or even get to the point where we can withdraw troops, you must fund diplomacy and development. You must have people on the ground who are rebuilding civil society, schools, jobs, all of that. It's not nation building, but it's at least actively developing. And you must have diplomats who can negotiate. So the military, and Secretary Gates was very strong on this point during the Obama administration, they will speak up for state and USAID. I'm not sure they'll get their way.
Do you think, though, the world is more dangerous, or we just know more about it?
I think we know more about it. You know, most of the studies of the numbers of deaths, we're way, way down, even accounting for population increases. And obviously, if you think about that, even, you know, before 1945, so World War I, it's not illegal at that point to invade another country, right? If you think about the 20th century, we had two of the worst wars ever. But we also put in place this rule-based order that says you can't just invade another country for territory or ethnic reasons or anything else. And, of course, we still have horrific conflicts internally, but in terms of the scale of death, and destruction, we are actually in a far safer time.
More from Anne-Marie Slaughter after this short break. Her new book is The Chessboard and the Web. Let us know what you think. Email us or send us a tweet and stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Artie Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let's get back to my conversation with Anne-Marie Slaughter, the head of the think tank New America, former dean of Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School, and former director of policy and planning for the State Department. We spoke last Friday for a WHYY member event in Princeton.
Is it true we don't win anymore? I mean, certainly the president talks about winning. I think he has a certain definition in his mind, but if the enemy is ISIS or ISIL or some of these terrorist threats, how do you win that? What does that look like?
Yes.
Or is that even possible? Or you just live with sort of like organized crime. You live with the threat.
Yes. Frankly. I mean, I think we are in a world in which most wars, not all, but most conflict, let's put it that way, can be reduced and managed, but not won. So if you think about hybrid war, and you think about the way the Russians have gone into Ukraine and destabilized parts of Ukraine, and similarly when they went into Syria, although Syria was always already coming apart, where you have a combination of irregular forces, you have psychological operations, you have cyber operations, and then you have sort of diplomacy, but often that diplomacy is kind of just shadow boxing because it provides a veneer of maybe we're going to get somewhere while what's going on the ground is a kind of tug of war. Very hard to know how you'd win that. I think you can shore up defenses, and I actually write about that, how you build networks of resilience to make it harder to destabilize countries or parts of countries. So there are defenses we can build up, and there are going to be ways in which, you know, we can probably reach settlements in various places, but outright victory of the kind, we haven't had a peace treaty, right? It really was certainly not in Vietnam, not in any war since. So that we are going to have to get used to living with levels of conflict and, of course, threats that are at home as well as abroad. But we can do that.
Here's another question from the audience. Do you think the Trump administration appreciates the web of interconnectedness? Can they think ahead many steps as you describe the web? They certainly know about Twitter.
Yes. Yes. I mean, so look, part of one way of understanding what I've been talking about is that there is a network or a connected set of parties and people and thinkers who share a new nationalism, a culturally conservative, religiously grounded, and again, this is not anti-religion in the least, but a particular vision of where you have to go, sense of the West is under threat, or even, as I use the Turkish example, even in Islam, right? That's part of the fight you're seeing in Islam. I think the Trump administration, they are actively encouraging right-wing parties in Europe, right? Actively, because that's the same view. If you listen to Marine Le Pen and some of what she says, or look at Viktor Orban in Hungary, or look at what the Justice Department in Poland, right? This, and so they understand that, I think, quite well, and they understand interconnected communications.
Putting Hillary Clinton aside, because I know you wanted her to be president of the United States, if women ran the world, or there were more women running the world, would we be in better shape?
Yes.
I see more women applauding than men, I will just say. But
would I want a world only run by women? No. I wouldn't. You don't want a world run only by women any more than you want a world run only by men. You want a world run by women and men. But definitely, I unquestionably think that more women in positions of power nationally and everywhere would, A, better reflect the population. Let's just start with that. I don't believe all women think differently than all men. No, absolutely not. But I'll give you an example. When I talk about power with versus power over, network power versus the hierarchical power, the power to command versus the power to mobilize, women and digital natives all nod their heads. Right? Many of us think this way more naturally because we haven't been in a position to exercise the power of command, but we know how to mobilize the power of a network because we've had to. So that's just one example. And not all women think that way. Plenty of men get it too. But that would be good to have that different perspective when you have the G20, it'd be great if there were 10 women and 10 men around that table, and lots of other kinds of diversity as well.
Well, speaking of Hillary Clinton, because I feel the need to ask you, since you work so closely with her, do you think she lost? I mean, she won the popular vote, but she lost the election because she was Hillary Clinton, or because she was a woman, or some combination of the two?
So that question's probably overdetermined. And there were many reasons she lost.
Something.
I think certainly she was held to standards as a woman that she would not have been as a man, that many men I know said, I'd love to have a woman president. I just don't like Hillary. But I've been around a long time, and I have sat in many hiring committees, and I have heard many times men say, I want a woman, absolutely, just not that woman. And that woman, she has sharp elbows, or, she's a little aggressive, or, she could be a little shrill, whatever it might be, they are not conscious that they're actually, that's bias. They really aren't. They really believe, consciously, absolutely, I want a woman. They really believe it's just that one, except the numbers don't lie. And that's a different standard. And so I think there was a lot of that. I think there are other factors as well.
Do you think, another question from the audience, do you think the press is scrutinizing the Trump administration more than Obama's during your time there? If so, is there something from your tenure at the State Department that you are glad went, quote unquote, unreported? Ooh, we're all ears now. But the first part.
Well, every email I ever sent her was recorded. And so it was reported, but that wasn't, there was plenty that was scrutinized. Do I think
the press is harder on the Trump administration? I love when guests think before they answer. Let me just say, it's very refreshing.
Yes and no. I mean, so here's how I would look at it. I do think that, I don't think there's any media that can be completely objective. We can't have completely objective. It's a question of how you frame the story and what you expect. So here's what I would say. Fox News and lots of the press that were more conservative were every bit as tough. Just incredibly tough on President Obama. You know, there was nothing he could do to put a foot right. And in that sense, I think absolutely not. I think the investigative reporters of the Washington Post and the New York Times and others are probably working overtime more in this administration than the last one. But I also think there is more to look at.
I know when some of Hillary Clinton's emails came out, there were some emails that you wrote to her that were just between the two of you.
Yes.
That came public, and the ones that interested me had to do with Libya and some other things as well. But I'm curious about what that was like to all of a sudden have what you thought was a private correspondence hit the light of day.
Not particularly fun. And of course, I wouldn't read on WikiLeaks. Suddenly, I'd discover on Twitter, I would suddenly start getting people asking me questions about things on Twitter or on email, and I'd go, uh-oh, I guess I better go check what came out. You know, there's one thing I wrote when I was writing about Israel where I really would have used a different word choice, right, for sure. But in general, I never wrote her anything that I would disown, except that word choice. I mostly felt, and I do feel this strongly, and you're seeing it now, I put very little in email now. And that means that, but in that situation, that means now she would get much less from me, right, because I could email her things where I wasn't going to call her up and I wasn't going to see her because she's the Secretary of State. And so once you disable the ability to correspond privately, you mean that our people who are in positions of power are just not going to get as much good advice if ever you have to be on the phone or you have to call a meeting. So I mostly felt, this is a real pity, because next time I'm in the State Department, I won't be writing these things, but it doesn't mean she'll be hearing them through another channel or Pete.
You do say in this book, though, that face-to-face,
yes,
contact or conversations is still a very powerful thing.
Indeed. Indeed. I do. And in fact, there's a lot where I write about managing networks and power, and there's no, you do need a blend of both, without question. I think we have gotten to the point, even in my own organization, where you find that you're writing something to somebody three doors down, or in my household, my husband will be upstairs and I could be downstairs, and so I do think face to face is critically important, and I think we are redressing that balance a little bit.
Well, here's a really good basic question. What is a think tank?
Ah, yes. I'm laughing only because my mother is still saying, could you please explain what New America does? A think tank.
And this is for Mom.
Yes, no. A think tank is a policy research institute, which essentially means a think tank is what the Woodrow Wilson School does. It's a people who think about solving public problems, education, the future of work, family and social policy, foreign policy, public problems, right? Whatever we have that we need to solve as a polity, as citizens. But the difference is, when Brookings was founded, the nation's first big think tank, it was called a university without students. So no teaching, just thinking. The teaching helps you think. And traditionally, it was a highly technocratic vision of how government should get better. It was the progressive era 100 years ago where good government thought, well, what we need are people who are experts, who figure out the right answers and communicate those answers to Congress, to members of the executive. We still need that, but actually my own think tank is more than a think tank. We're also, we're an action tank, but we mostly believe we need to be out in the country, listening to what's happening on the ground and tapping into that, rather than sitting in our own offices in Washington or New York or wherever, thinking about what the right solution is. So I think the era of the pure think tank is passing.
So what do you think about our world? Are you optimistic?
I am optimistic, although I think we are in a very, very scary time. So
scary how?
Well,
scary
so I'm up. So I think in the first place that we cannot take for granted that the system will hold. As I said earlier, I've lived through a circumstance in which a president was doing things a president should not do that were illegal, and the system held right and left. I think now there are deeply authoritarian tendencies there. Again, the idea that the press is the enemy of the people. You can disagree with individual members of the press and newspapers, but the press, without a free press, democracy does not exist. And a press that can criticize you, and that is a good thing. And right, if you listen to John F. Kennedy in his administration, he said, "Of course, you know, I didn't like what I read, but I sure was glad I was able to read it." That is what. So I'm worried about the media. I'm worried about accountability. I am worried deeply about the demonization and polarization in this country. The idea that we cannot look at each other and say, we are parents and children and siblings and have people we love and we care about our country, even if we radically disagree about where, how to get where we want to go. We actually have similar goals. You know, we've got to get back to that. So I'm frightened both for what could happen to the country and what could happen to the world. But in the end, I believe that our institutions will hold, and I believe that our citizens will push back on forces that I do not think represent all of us. I think these forces represent relatively few of us, maybe 20% on the extremes, and that the vast majority of us want to work together and want a country that we may disagree on how to get there, but we believe we can actually work together and find solutions.
So I have the perfect question to end the hour. Would you ever consider running for U.S. president? Please? Have you ever considered elective office? Ever?
My normal response is yes, but my husband would kill me. But my husband's in the front row, so I've often said that if I lived in Britain, where you had 6-week campaigns and public financing, I'd run tomorrow. Absolutely, I have thought about it, but I think right now, right, frankly, rather than focusing on who should run, we need to focus on what that person's going to say. We need to focus on what are the answers, and then we can figure out how we're going to actually elect the people who can implement them.
Well, on that note, Anne-Marie Slaughter, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for your questions.
Anne-Marie Slaughter is the author of The Chessboard and the Web and is the head of the think tank New America. Thanks to our engineers, Joyce Lieberman and John Knapp, for making the interview at Princeton sound so good. Also thanks to WHYY's Brittany Smith for making it happen, and Maggie Layden and Ellen Steele for their assistance. John Ahrens produced and edited the show. Charlie Kyer, our engineer today. Let us know what you think. Send us an email and tweet us with your comments. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.